Ms. Faust, is there anyone here today on behalf of Mr. Olivera Cotino? Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Stacey Faust, Assistant Attorney General representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. This is an appeal of the district court order denying Olivera Cotino post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. The district court also did not appoint him post-conviction counsel. The state's position is that the district court was correct in both respects. A little way of background, the jury convicted Olivera Cotino of 3 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of theft by deception over $1,500. His conviction stems from his orchestration and involvement in the brutal, heinous murders of the Zisbonic family and the theft from their bank accounts. The state's key witness at trial was Olivera Cotino's co-defendant, Valdir Goncalves Santos. Olivera Cotino had the same counsel at trial and on direct appeal, so that post-conviction is his first opportunity to raise any ineffective assistance of counsel claims. He did so in a nearly 60-page motion to the district court. Although I have combined them in my brief, Olivera Cotino raises approximately 39 claims of ineffective assistance of trial and appellate counsel. I've never quite seen a case where it seems like every issue of criminal law has been touched upon between the defendant's direct appeal and his post-conviction. So I'm here today to try to answer any questions that this court may have as to any of his claims.
Well, there's several surrounding aiding and abetting.
Yes.
There's a cluster.
Yes.
Could you advise us of the state's understanding of what issues are raised, maybe newly raised, which were and or were not ruled on below?
Well, I mean, all of his claims were ruled on below in the sense that the district court starts out his order with that not believing that he's alleged sufficient allegations of prejudice, but even if he has, the direct appeal shows that he cannot establish prejudice.
But did that sweeping statement, was it a failure to allege or that the proof is sufficient to uphold a conviction?
Well, I think
there's a sweeping statement in there. I think we're talking about the same thing.
Yes. But,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was both. The district court starts out with, I can only find, you know, bare assertions or general assertions of prejudice within your allegation, within your motion. But even if, you know, you have alleged them, you know, look at the facts in the direct appeal opinion and, you know, district court believed he couldn't establish the requisite prejudice showing.
So now I'm back to asking for some help on
yes.
aiding and abetting and what's on deck.
Yes.
Thank you.
So he alleged, I have them boiled down to about 5 as to aiding and abetting, that he should have been arraigned on aiding and abetting. But case law is clearly to the contrary, since aiding and abetting is not a separate crime. I think what fundamentally Olivera Cotino misunderstands is he thinks aiding and abetting is an alternative theory of first-degree murder, and it's not. It's not a separate crime. He thinks that the felony murder instruction was erroneous because it omitted that he knew that the actual perpetrator possessed the requisite intent, but that element, if you will, was included in the aiding and abetting instruction at instruction number 8, although it may not have been included in the felony murder instruction. He thinks that he alleges that there was no evidence other than Goncalves Santos' bought testimony, and when he refers to bought or purchased testimony, he's talking about the Goncalves Santos plea agreement with the state. He doesn't think other than that bought testimony that the evidence was sufficient to show that he aided and abetted felony murder. The state submits, although there was corroborating evidence, Goncalves Santos' testimony was all that the state needed. And the jury obviously believed him, and they knew about his plea agreement with the state. He also alleges that counsel didn't advise him that he could be convicted as an aider and abettor. The state's position is this fails for insufficient allegations. He frankly never alleged that he would have accepted a plea offer from the state and not gone to trial if he had known that information. He wavered instead on...
So in that regard, there's some attachments to the amended complaint? Okay. Is this right? The prejudice he claims is that his lawyers didn't advise him, he was subject to aiding and abetting, and if he had known, he would have pursued plea agreements. Is that...
That's what he should have alleged. That's what he should have alleged. Instead, his allegations wavered on, well, I might have thought more about the plea agreement. It was my choice whether I should go to trial. He never, ever says or alleges that he would have accepted the plea offer from the state and proceeded to trial.
So for purposes of argument, if the allegation were sufficient, what would be the applicable law? Is it deficient to not tell your client that you're subject to aiding and abetting?
Well, I think that we probably have to talk to counsel and find out if they had that discussion. I can certainly envision, he doesn't have to be charged with it. It's not a separate crime, but I can certainly envision a scenario where, perhaps somebody like Oliver Cantinho, where he didn't actually inflict any of the wounds himself, but he commanded it. He was the orchestrator. He instructed it that he might think he could be found not guilty because he didn't actually kill the person. I think trial counsel should have discussed
if the allegation were sufficient.
If the allegation were sufficient, but the state admits it's not.
The other area that I'm not quite sure is how it's alleged, but I think you'll know what I'm talking about. I hope. So prosecutorial misconduct in connection with the lawyer that was present for the statement prior to giving a statement.
Oh, Mr. Kaler.
Mr. Kaler.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how do you understand the complaint? Thank you.
You're welcome. I understand his complaint, although he never cites to it, and this is what he spends the majority of his motion on, right, is that he thinks the state appointed him counsel for his March 11th statements. And if you read through his motion, all of his law and his analysis, he never cites to the case, but he's referring to State versus Bain, basically copied and pasted this court's analysis from State versus Bain. And Bain was a Sixth Amendment right to counsel case where prosecutors came into possession of confidential communications between the defendant and his client. Well, the reason that is different here is because Oliver Cantinho's Sixth Amendment right to counsel had not attached at the time that he spoke to defense attorney Matt Kaler on March 11th. He was being detained on an ICE hold. He was not there on state charges. And the Sixth Amendment right to counsel doesn't attach until after the initiation of judicial criminal proceedings.
That seems to be a strange procedure. How does the county attorney appoint a lawyer for the defendant in this case? Maybe you've just answered this, but does not that raise problems for you?
It's not the best practice. I would agree. He didn't appoint him. There was no official appointment. Matt Kaler was never appointed to this case. Matt Kaler testified. There was a suppression hearing here. And Matt Kaler testified that both Sergeant Negron and the county attorney, Don Klein, called him because basically they were looking for a Spanish-speaking defense attorney. To be able to help Mr. Oliver Cantinho. And
was there a court involved with this process at all?
No. And it would present a problem for me, but for the facts of this case, because Mr. Kaler did arrive and we had the suppression hearing, and he testified that despite his advice to Oliver Cantinho wanted to talk. That is in favor of the state, and what's further in favor of the state is that what matters is what happened at Oliver Cantinho's trial, and the state never introduced his statements at trial.
But I think his allegation may be that he shared his thinking with the lawyer who arrived. I'm not sure the right word.
Sure. To the extent that there was anything he provided to Mr. Kaler outside of what he divulged himself to law enforcement through his own statements, he hasn't alleged it. I have no idea what that confidential trial strategy is or what he told Mr. Kaler, what Mr. Kaler allegedly told state officials. I have no idea. He hasn't alleged it. And you would
and
think he would
the
be
able record, to... is the state's position the record would refute that because Kaler was a witness at the motion to suppress?
Yes. And also because basically no harm, no foul. I mean, his statements didn't come in here at trial. He, the only way that any physical fruits of those statements would have also been inadmissible would have been if his statements were involuntary. And they weren't. They were voluntary because he contacted Detective Spencer himself and wanted to speak to him. He wanted to speak to him. He just wanted to talk to a lawyer first, and he did. And that lawyer told him, basically, I understand that you want to tell on these other two people, but understand that you're still a suspect, and I advise you against it. And he did it anyway.
Thank you.
There are no further questions. We ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.